Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Mark Levin of the Right on Crime Project in Austin, Texas. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Nice to have you with us this evening. Our phone lines will be open a little bit later in the broadcast during our second hour this evening. But again, we thank you very much for being with us tonight. But tonight we have something special for you, an in-depth conversation about an important aspect of life in America and one that is both very costly and grossly inefficient. It's our criminal justice system, and specifically our prison system. It's a system that was built to lock up the bad guys and protect the good guys. But it has become another government program gone amok, a system that has been allowed to decay in an atmosphere of ill-conceived, feel-good measures that waste money and lives. Just like welfare reform took decades of grassroots conservative rants before Congress finally passed reforms, the reform of the justice system in the United States and our prison system will not happen overnight. But the needed discussion of our criminal justice failures and needed reforms begins tonight on Beyond the Beltway. We begin with some startling facts. One out of every 100 adults in America is incarcerated, a total population of approximately 2.3 million people. In 1970, it was one out of every 400. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but 23% of the world's prisoners. Over the past 13 years, the proportion of prisoners who were incarcerated for committing nonviolent crimes has risen an alarming 189%. By contrast, the proportion of inmates who committed violent crimes dropped by 28%. A state's daily prison costs an average of $79 per day, compared to less than $3.50 per day for probation. The cost is between $18,000 to $50,000 per prisoner per year to lock people up in this country. In 2009, the number of federal inmates rose by 3.4%, and federal prisons today are now 60% over capacity. To lead us in our discussion, we welcome Mark Levin. He is with the Right on Crime Project of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And Mark, thank you for being with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Well, thank you. And you certainly set the table in a tremendously effective way for this discussion.
Well, thank you very much. I have argued that conservatives should be the most outraged people in the country because they're known for being strong law and order, but they want efficiency in government. So my question to you is the number of prisoners, the way that we're sending people away, a politician would argue and say, well, that's what the people wanted. The people demanded that we start sending people away. So what's your answer to that question?
Well, you know, it all boils down to basically distinguishing those people we're afraid of versus those we're just mad at. And unfortunately, what we saw was, you know, back in the 60s, there was this attitude, if it feels good, do it. And there was kind of a Pollyannish idea that every offender could be made into a perfect person. But then kind of conservatives reacted against that, which was not working, that approach. And, you know, in the early 70s, crime started to increase. We did need more prisons, but we kind of went overboard. So it's like a pendulum effect. We actually, since the early 70s, our prison population in this country has grown sixfold. And so what happened was there were some violent people that we needed to lock up. And so we did that. But at the same time, we also we widened the net. We swept in a lot of low-level drug and property offenders. We got people in prison, whether it's a small amount of drugs or shoplifting or hot checks, that really they need to pay restitution. They need to get clean and stop using drugs and be productive workers in this country. And so fortunately, we've seen a growing amount of research over the last 10 or 20 years that shows some programs, whether it's drug courts or swift and certain sanctions and probation programs, things that actually can work and give us less crime for less money. And that's what Right on Crime is about.
Now, from a political perspective, whether it's in Illinois, certainly I know the history here, and I would assume it's similar in other states, certainly large industrial states. Those lawmakers from rural parts of the state, they want a piece of the state budget, when they're divvying up the budget deals at the end of the General Assembly session. And in many cases, crime is more rampant or perceived to be more rampant in the larger urban areas. So what you have as a trade-off is you have Democrats who maybe control the big cities of the country. They make their legislative deals with their conservative brethren in central Illinois or the southern part of the state or outside the big cities. It doesn't have to be unique to Illinois. And the trade-off is, I'll build you a prison, and then the people back home say, well, you build me a prison, then I can hire my brother-in-law, you know, to be an inmate or to make business, and it becomes an economic engine for the rural parts of states. Isn't that a fact of life politically?
It's absolutely true, and it's true in this state, Illinois, where we're sitting. It's very true in New York. When Mario Cuomo was governor, a very liberal guy, he promised upstate Republican senators prisons for their district in exchange for supporting other parts of his legislative agenda. Now, the great part is Andrew Cuomo, his son, has actually closed, finally, these upstate prisons that were half empty that were just being kept open as jobs programs. And so we are making progress on this, but it is still a problem where you see prisons kept open simply to create jobs, which is a conservative should be the most outraged by that, because government, it's the job of the private sector to create jobs, not the government. We should have every prison bed we need for public safety, but not a single one more.
But again, people who look at things in a fiscal way, and conservatives frequently do that, they want to make sure that they're not making a fiscal decision that's going to affect public safety. So how do you address that issue? Because how do you protect those that need, everyone needs to be protected, but how do you put away the right people?
Right. Well, I think we start with the premise. The one thing prisons do really well is incapacitate. We don't see a lot of prison escapes. So for people that are murderers, rapists, et cetera, having them serve long prison terms is a very good use of prison cells, a very good use of taxpayer money. Now, with you take a person with a drug habit, our real goal is to get them off drugs and get them working, hopefully. And a prison doesn't do real well at that. In fact, it tends to be a revolving door for these short prison sentences. And then when you look at it, when they come out of prison, a lot of these nonviolent, low-risk offenders are actually worse because they meet the really bad guys in prison and they get acclimated to that prison culture, which is usually very detrimental. And, of course, when they come back in the community, they're usually their family ties are severed. They can't get a job. We found in Texas people couldn't get a barber's license who had had a drug conviction 10 or 20 years ago, and yet we were with taxpayer dollars training people in prison to be barbers. So it didn't make any sense. And we said, look, after you've done the time, you should be able to punch the clock. We actually got a bill passed so those people could get provisional licenses to go into these occupations after they've been convicted of something. So it we've got to basically say for the people that are in a danger, here's what you've got to do. You've got to go through drug tests. You've got to pay restitution, do all these things in the community. And, you know, there are still nonviolent offenders who need to go to prison if you keep burglarizing, that sort of thing. You do have to draw the line at some point. But the good news is there's a lot of research about what can work in the community, whether it's a drug court or electronic monitoring. Some people need mental health treatment, and those things can give us less crime for less
money. When we come back, I want to talk about something else, and that is mandatory minimums, where judges, their hands are tied. They have to do certain things because Congress thinks it's a good idea to do it, when in reality it may not be a good idea. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly for tonight's discussion of crime and criminal justice in America. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. First portion of our broadcast this evening is not taking calls. The second hour we will, and we're talking about the American criminal justice system and the over-incarceration of Americans. And Mark Levin of the Texas Public Policy Foundation and Right on Crime joins us. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But we're talking about the what has led to the over-incarceration of people in America. And there is an element that, or things, or one of the points you want to change, is you want consideration of eliminating mandatory minimums. What are mandatory minimums? What crimes do they involve? And why are they a not so good thing?
Well, to put it briefly, they are where a politician's judgment is substituted for that of the judge or jury. And so basically, and mandatory minimum is where the statute, the law says that for a certain offense, this person has to go to prison for a certain length of time, regardless of what other facts there are, regardless of what the offender's prior record is, if any, regardless of what sentence the victim may want. And so the better approach, we think, is to give judges and juries discretion. Now, not unlimited. There are ranges. Like in Texas, we don't really have mandatory minimums. We have ranges. So you could get probation or prison, you know, from 2 to 10 years for third-degree felony, for example. But the judge and jury look at the individual facts of the case, including the whether this person's a first-time offender or a career criminal, what the victim wants, whether the person's remorseful. There are just so many facts that every case is different, and that's why I think our system where the judge and jury look at the specifics and then craft a sentence to fit the crime is the best way.
So as I referenced in my opening comments, ill-conceived. It's an ill-conceived idea because one size does not fit all, nor should it fit all insofar as prisons are concerned, and certainly a sentence.
Yeah.
There are extenuating circumstances.
That's true. And, you know, and there may be cases where it's worse and they should get a longer sentence. But that, you know, to me, we're paying judges and we're empaneling juries to do the work. So let's let them do the work.
But recently, the United States Sentencing Commission has met in Washington. And as I understand it, they are exploring whether or not they will reduce and reform some of these points.
Yes, well, Congress is looking at it, and they did, for example, about a year ago, narrow the crack and powder cocaine disparity. And there are a lot of conservative members of Congress, Senator Cornyn from our state of Texas, Dan Lundgren, the former California Attorney General, very conservative, spoke in support of that on the floor of Congress. So the tide has shifted on these issues. New York abolished the Rockefeller drug mandatory minimums that dealt with drug possession and so forth. So most of the mandatory minimums, not all, but a lot of them that are still left deal with violent and sex offenses. But there are still states that have, like Florida, mandatory minimums for drug offenses. And lo and behold, Florida is one of those states. They just went over 100,000 inmates. They are seeing growing prison populations and costs. And so it really is part of what's needed is to give judges and juries the make sure they have the authority to craft that sentence to fit the specifics of the offense.
Now, on a federal basis, one of the fastest growing crimes, I understand, is child pornography. Not necessarily the production of it, which is obviously a major offense, but even possession of child pornography could get you sent to prison for many, many years.
Well, it's true. And I mean, it's a serious offense. And actually, I have a friend from college. My best friend is a federal prosecutor in Florida, and he's dealt with many of those cases. And typically, there are people who have, you know, distributed a fair amount of this, the ones that go in the federal system, child pornography through the computer and something throughout the country or even internationally. And, you know, obviously it victimizes children, and it's a matter that's frankly morally repugnant. And so it's you know, I think that is one of those instances where, frankly, prison is a deterrent. It's a deterrent for white-collar criminals like Bernie Madoff, because these are people that are not poor like the average street criminal. These are people that, you know, we're making money off of this, living nice lifestyles, and the threat of actually going to prison, this is the one place where deterrence seems to work pretty well for people having a nice lifestyle.
But again, insofar as that particular case, again, a one-size-fit-all, a person who engages in that is different than someone who's a child molester where there's been a hands-on contact. But at the moment, they're all sort of lumped together. Again, sort of a one-size-fits-all, part of the mandatory minimum requirement.
Sure, and the minimums are probably different for those, but still, I think the mandatory minimums, if you're going to have them, which I'm not sure you should, they really ought to focus on those where you have the actual physical harm to somebody.
Now, speaking of that, one of the other things you want to talk about is to consider geriatric release programs. There's over 200,000 American prisoners who are over 50 years old, and I know of some cases where people are 75 or 80 years old and they're in prison.
Well, it's true. And, you know, now we just saw, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court decision about a month ago on juvenile life without parole. And so you could have somebody who commits a crime when they're 13 or 14. And let's be truthful, these are usually very heinous crimes. But they commit a crime when they're 13 or 14, and to have them still be in prison when they're 80 under a mandatory sentence, which is what the issue was in the case, when they're 80 years old on a respirator for something they did when they were 13 or 14, that they're not a danger anymore, I think most people would say there's a more cost-effective way to use our prison cells, that there's people who are dangerous that need to be in those cells. So I think it's a matter of common sense. Most states have some type of parole review process where they look at geriatric inmates and those that, whether it's because they're physically unable or for other reasons, just aren't a risk to the public anymore.
You've also suggested that you should look for options, parole and probation. When, as part of a parole system, you mentioned, I think it was, I said, like $3.50 a day versus some much larger $79 a day for an individual prisoner. But when you look at, that is yet another bureaucracy. In other words, if we were to go to probation, would it automatically mean that it would be more efficient? Because wouldn't you have to hire more officers? Is it necessarily a cost-saving reform, or is it a common-sense reform?
Well, you bring up a great point, because a lot of the challenge today is doing probation better and more efficiently, and parole for that matter, both forms of community supervision. And so what we found is in a lot of cities, it used to be you'd have one big probation office downtown. And, you know, let's say San Antonio was an example. Here's a city that's 20 or 30 square miles. And so what you need is what we've done in Austin, Texas, Travis County. You've got neighborhood probation offices where that officer is supervising folks in that neighborhood, so they're not spending all day driving. They're actually spending the day talking to their and watching those under their supervision. And then you use risk and needs assessments, which are quantitative instruments that score somebody's risks and needs. And so you can match the level of supervision and programs to those risks and needs. And so for example, you have a CEO who has a first-time DWI. He's never been in the criminal justice system before. He doesn't need to come to the probation office once a week. It's a waste of time. All right. You know, it's maybe he'll lose his job if you've got a productive person like that who's a low risk, low-level first-time offender, then you actually you don't want to be devoting your resources to them. You want to focus on those people who are most likely to slip up. So that's really important. And then making sure that you don't just let violations. So violations of probation can be missing meetings, testing positive for marijuana. These are all called technical violations. Now, the old model was you just let them pile up, and then you revoke them to prison for whatever's left on their sentence for 5, 10, 15 years. Now, what we're seeing is much more effective. It's like disciplining a child. They touch the stove, you have a swift and certain sanction right there, and you don't throw the book at them, but you increase their term of probation, electronic monitoring, a whole range of things. And what we've all the research is showing, it's the swiftness and sureness of the sanction more than the severity that gets results.
One of the biggest, looking at the politics, which is what we do frequently on this program, and that is looking at the politics of it. No elected official, be they Republican or Democrat, wants to be viewed as soft on crime. But yet your organization is called Right on Crime. And I've argued over the years that it's really the conservatives and their constant, I mean multi-decade long discussion and haranguing about the welfare system that finally led to the reforms that I referenced in my opening. But your organization it's the conservative approach. Tell us about the statement of principles that you have, and share with the audience some of the conservative superstars that sign on to your program, because they're not the most left-wing members of Congress, and people might perceive them as being, you know, great political leaders, but they're conservatives. And they're talking common sense about the issues we're talking about tonight.
That's exactly right. Well, the Right on Crime Statement of Principles has been signed by Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, Newt Gingrich, Bill Bennett, the former drug czar, Ed Meese, former attorney general under President Reagan, Grover Norquist. The list goes on. People can obviously see it at rightoncrime.com. But what they've all united around is the idea that we need a criminal justice system that is held accountable. We need to hold offenders accountable. We need to hold the system accountable. And traditionally, I think our system has grown when it fails, and we actually need a system that rewards results. And one of the things we talk about in our statement of principles is funding based on performance. So if you're funding a program for offenders, let's not just pay for it based on how many offenders are in the program, but based on how much recidivism you reduce, which is reoffending for those who don't know the terminology. But let's pay for results. And that's part of what we've been doing in welfare reform and education reform.
Speaking of education, what happened to the days that when you went to prison, there was supposed to be some form of reform? There was some education, there was some training programs so that when you got out, you just didn't learn to be a better, criminal. You would learn to skill. I understand that in many prisons, including federal prisons, there are no such programs. There are no programs to dealing with a variety of issues that sent people to prison in the first place. So they're untrained. They sit there. Their lives are wasted. Totally wasted.
It's absolutely right. It's hit or miss in terms of these. And, there's a phrase which is three hots and a cot. And, for the average person, being in prison is a pretty terrifying thought. But if you're on the street, have a very difficult life, part of which is in many of these cases certainly self-inflicted. But going to prison, you get free health care. It provides, and I'm not saying these places are pleasant. They're not, except some of the federal prison Bernie Madoff in is pretty pleasant. But most of the state prisons certainly are not. But the point is that inside the prisons, one of the research has shown vocational programs. If they learn to be a welder, that's one of the best things you could do. Their recidivism is much lower when they come out.
We want to talk more about that when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. From Austin, Texas to Anaheim, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We will be taking telephone calls at 1-800-723-8289 in our second hour this evening. 1-800-723-8289. But again, right now we're engaged in an hour-long discussion, so we really can get deep into the subject of some of the reforms that are needed in the American criminal justice system. Mark Levin joins us. He is a senior policy advisor for the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and the organization that you're with is Right on Crime. And in 50 words or less, just summarize again for those that just tuned in, what is it? And there's a website, obviously, and people can go and learn a lot more about your nationwide efforts. It's not just in the federal system, state by state, although I notice you don't have too much going on in Illinois.
Well, we're working on it, but the Right on Crime is we make the conservative case for criminal justice reform, and we're anchored by our statement of principles, which is signed by Jeb Bush, Newt Gingrich, former drug czar Bill Bennett, and many others. And so liberals have frequently been the ones focusing on criminal justice reform. So we felt the voice of conservatives, particularly focused on accountability, saving money, and lowering crime, was really what was needed in this debate. So we fill that vacuum.
And also, I think an important thing that I mentioned in the opening is the loss of lives. It is we spend as rightfully we should as a nation and as members of the media. We spend a great deal of time paying tribute to the men and women who go and serve our country and to the families that are left behind. And we shouldn't move from that passion that we have one iota. But there's another population. It's the one we're talking about tonight. 2.3 million Americans incarcerated. And behind every one of those individuals, there's probably four or five, maybe six or seven extended families of people whose lives are devastated. And if you have a loved one who is incarcerated, it can affect your life as well. And if you've gone to visit them, and I have visited friends who are in prison myself in the course of my life, and one of the saddest moments is to be in that visitation room. It isn't necessarily through a barbed wire like it was in the movies. They're pretty much open areas in most areas of the country now. But one of the saddest things is when you see a young child or the wife or the husband of someone who's been incarcerated. And you see that moment when they meet at visitation time. And you see the sadness and you see the joy when they have to leave. And so tonight, we're looking at the total impact, not only on the loss of lives and the wasted lives of those that are in prison, but also those and the families that they leave behind. And in saying that and in offering that moment and that feeling of compassion for those that are incarcerated, again, we do not want to dismiss, excuse what sent them to prison and maybe the lives that they took or the devastation they created. There's no question they belong doing some crime, some time, somewhere. They did a crime. They've got to do the time. The question that we're discussing tonight is, what is the right amount of time, and is there a more effective and efficient way to make sure that that person who committed a crime against society doesn't return again and again? And unfortunately, three cots and a meal, as Mark was just saying, to many of the people that are there, you know, prison is the best thing that ever happened to them, because that's their life. They don't really want to get out. And yet there are a much larger number of people who are there. They're doing the time. And the question is, are they doing the right amount of time? And is there a more effective and efficient way while they are there serving their country in a really bizarre way because of the federal laws or state laws they've broken? Is there a better way to use that time in prison more effectively and efficiently? And that's what we're discussing tonight. So it is, you know, people always talk about that conservatives are not the people that are compassionate. It's only the liberals that are compassionate. Well, if you're a regular listener to this and a viewer of this program, you know that I don't believe that. I don't think you believe that. And tonight we're talking about the conservative perspective on fighting crime in America and making the justice system a little more just, because it isn't always just. And again, you hear liberals saying that a lot, but tonight we're hearing some conservatives offer the same concerns and offering some reforms.
Well, those are great points, and I would amplify it when we look at the issue of victims of crime, because I'll tell you, let's talk about property crime. You know, an 8-year-old in my neighborhood takes something out of my garage. We could go through months of trials and testimony and all of that. But what I really want is I want whatever he took out of my garage back, and I want him to learn a lesson. I want an apology. And so one of the things we've looking at is restorative justice, the idea of victim-offender conferencing, where we have a binding agreement to make restitution, perform community service, and if that doesn't get met, then that 8-year-old can go get put on trial. And it can be used for adults as well. And it's had tremendous studies showing it reduces recidivism. It makes the offender understand they harmed an actual individual. They didn't just violate the words of a statute, and that's very powerful. And I'll tell you, if you look at not only do the collateral consequences of incarceration in terms of billions of child support inmates, for example, mothers who are separated from their children, all that, but when it comes to restitution for victims, we showed in Texas that those on probation paid $60 million in victim restitution. Those in prison paid less than $500,000 in restitution fines and fees combined. So certainly there are people that need to go to prison because they're a danger. But if you're interested in making the victim whole and having a justice that restores the victim, prison isn't going to do that.
Now, recently, the U.S. Judiciary Senate Committee, they looked into the federal prison system. And my question to you is the federal system about on par with state systems, or is it better run? I mean, here you had Congress looking into the Bureau of Prisons that you don't read too much about. They have one of the most powerful lobbies as well, but they're not being well run, are they?
It's very expensive, the federal system. Traditionally, if you go back a few decades, pretty much everyone in the federal system was an international criminal, a mobster, Manuel Noriega, or they were Bernie Madoff, a white collar.
Or terrorists.
Yeah, terrorists and all that. And what's happened is it's grown so much. And the biggest influx of people in the federal prison system has been the street level drug dealers of small amounts. These were people that used to have been prosecuted in the state system. Of course, they end up getting a lot more time in the federal system. There's no parole in the federal system, whereas many states have parole. So I think that the federal system has gotten too big. Justice Scalia was testifying before Congress several months ago, and he talked about how this growth in just the ordinary street crimes that used to never be a federal issue, the growth in those cases also clogged up the federal courts and prevented other matters from coming to trial. So it's a major concern for the federal judiciary as well.
One of the reasons I said a little bit earlier, we talked about sort of the political trade-off historically in states all over the country. That is, it is the conservative, rural, usually Republican lawmaker who gets a prison and who gets to put some prison guards to work in his town and that becomes the growth industry in his town, while they're sending away the bad folks from the larger cities, and in many cases they happen to be minorities. I mean, that's another political dynamic that we haven't addressed, but I think that's part of the reality we're dealing with. But when you're talking about the growth of the prison system, there's the new concept of the for-profit prisons. I want to get your thought on that. But what is the role of the unions? Because it seems to me that the prison unions around the country, they're the ones that in many cases are crying the loudest, lock them up and throw away the key. And yet, in many cases, their political allegiance is usually to a Democratic candidate. So we have a situation here where a political element within the body politics, you know, the labor unions are leading to some really bad implementation of federal and state laws.
Well, that's absolutely true. And California is the poster child for that. The prison guards union's given over $30 million to political campaigns. Lo and behold, the prison guards in California make twice as much as Texas. And California's going bankrupt. We're not going bankrupt in Texas. And of course,
they were behind the Arizona law as well. A combination of the prison guards unions, as well as those that favored private prisons, they provided a lot of the funding to the crackdown on illegal immigrants in the state of Arizona.
Well, yeah, and of course, that's a bit beyond our scope. But in California, the prison guards union supported the three strikes law, so including the provision that if their third strike is stealing a candy bar, you're out for life. You're in prison for the rest of your life. And there's actually a ballot measure that's going to be on the ballot in California in November to say the third strike has to be something more serious than stealing a candy bar for you to go out for the rest of your life in prison. But the prison guards union, you're absolutely right, had pushed these policies to increase the number of prisoners in California. And they also got, frankly, rewarded with a pay increase when Jerry Brown was governor. Now there have been some efforts in California now, basically because of a federal court order, to realign many offenders to the county level. And hopefully that will be effective. It's a challenge to do it all at once, but there are a number of counties, including, for example, San Diego County. We have a conservative Republican DA named Bonnie Dumanis, who's created an excellent plan that improves reentry and so forth. So there is some hope on the horizon in California. But the prison guards union have been a major part of the problem.
When we come back, I don't want to. I'll ask the question now, but it's unfair to ask you to try to answer it. But I'll set it up right now. And that is, obviously, many of the people who go to prison, whether they're for drug offenses or child pornography or whatever the case may be, there is need for some psychiatric and psychological testing and training and counseling that needs to happen. And I want to talk about the quality, if any, in the state and federal prisons that help deal with some of the mental aspects that sent people to prison in the first place. We'll continue with that when we come back from Chicago. Back in Chicago, Mark Levin is with us. He is with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and he is with an organization called RightOnCrime.com. And we are going to be taking telephone calls in the next hour, 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. Mark will be with us for the next hour. We wanted to spend the first hour just sort of engaging deeply into the subject, but we'll take calls 1-800-723-8289 in the next hour of Beyond the Beltway. Before the break, I talked about attempts to reform criminals, that there be education programs, training programs, training and psychological treatment for many of the people who are behind bars need that. How effective, how efficient, and how prevalent are those programs either in state or federal prisons?
Well, it certainly varies. And, you know, of course, you've got people that are severely mentally ill, and that's one group. And, you know, they may have schizophrenia, for example, and there are treatments for that that can stabilize these people. And in some instances, you have a lot of mentally ill people who don't commit serious offenses but keep committing misdemeanors like trespassing, public urination, things like that. And they literally go in and out of typically the county jail, very expensive. In Houston, they actually figured out who these top 50 frequent flyers, as they call them, were, and they would drive by their house with a therapist and a probation officer or a sheriff's deputy or whoever. They would come by there a few times a week and check on them, and it was amazing. It really drove down how many times they made sure they were on their medications, how many times they were coming into that jail. Because these were people that, because they came into the jail so much, were costing millions of dollars together, just 50 people. So I think that's a group there, the people that haven't committed a violent offense that are severely mentally ill. Now, then you do have those who are maybe mentally ill that do commit serious offenses, and frankly, some of those should probably be in a mental hospital, but they do need to be separated from the public if they're a danger. But you do have to distinguish between those people who know what they are doing that are evil.
But why can't courts do that now? I mean, if someone comes before a judge and clearly because of psychological testing that may have occurred, maybe a psychiatrist testified in that trial, why would a judge send someone who is at least apparently retarded in some way or mentally challenged in some way? Why would a judge send them to prison as opposed to some other way in which that person can be treated in a more humane way?
Well, one answer is, in a lot of places there are no alternatives that exist. But what we have seen is, for example, the development of mental health courts. The biggest one's in the Bronx. The one in Houston just started in March earlier this year. And this is where you have a specially trained judge with specially trained probation officer, specially trained prosecutor. And they all, it's more collaborative. It's not just adversarial. That's how a drug court is different, too. Everybody there is trying to get focused on the treatment of this offender to get them better.
How do we get that to happen more often? Because you mentioned that it's happening in Austin, or in Houston, rather. And by the way, we should mention that although Texas, because of its strong law and order image and its Old West image, and the fact most people know they put more people to death than any state, they're pretty strong on the capital punishment there. But you were based in Austin, Texas, and yet some of the most recent interesting reforms, including the one you mentioned in Houston, really have come out of Texas. Texas is one of the models for the nation in some of these new innovative procedures.
Absolutely. And let me first say, with respect to your question, one of the answers is that a lot of the money, so much of the money has gone into building and running more prisons that there hasn't been money for these other approaches. And one of the solutions that Texas and other states have been pursuing to that is to say to individual counties, if you want to do a mental health court, you want electronic monitoring, stronger probation, drug courts, whatever it may be, collaborations with law enforcement, you can say you will send fewer low-level offenders to prison in the next fiscal year, and in exchange, you'll get some of the savings to the state to use for your community-based programs for these lower-level offenders who can be safely supervised in the community. So that approach kind of addresses the fiscal imbalance in the system, which has been the counties just send people to the state because the state's paying for it.
Now, one of the fastest-growing line items in state budgets for the last 15 years has been corrections. But you argue that that number that may be in a budget somewhere in a state really is maybe a lowballed figure. Tell why.
Well, you have pension costs, for example, that aren't in typically the Department of Corrections budget. They're in some other budget. But that is 20%, like in Ohio, 20% of the state pensioners, state employees who are on pensions are people that were prison guards or other correctional officers. And so it's a huge cost in terms of that. Then you also have the interest you pay back on bonds to build prisons and so forth. So in Texas, you know, we in 2007, we faced a crossroads. The projection was we'd have to build 17,000 more prison beds. And instead, the legislature said, they turned to us and others to say, what could we do instead? And we put together an alternative package of drug courts, treatment programs for the mentally ill, and so forth. And so we've been able to, since that time, have about a 10% drop in both our incarceration rate and our crime rate. And we have to build those prisons.
If people like what they've heard tonight, how can they find you and how can they become involved in your organization to help right some of these wrongs?
Well, rightoncrime.com is our headquarters, and it really has a lot of resources, both in terms of research and articles, multimedia, podcasts, things people can do. They can sign up for our email list and, you know, also learn about the issue of overcriminalization, which is this growth in the number of criminal laws. About a week or two ago, a guy was...
I want to talk about that in the next hour. We're running out of time for this hour, but again, it's rightoncrime.com. Our guest has been Mark Levin, and he has been the senior policy advisor to the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He joins us tonight. Again, a reminder, we are going to take telephone calls in the next hour. If you're listening to this program on radio, there is a second hour, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway with our special guest this evening, Mark Levin. He is with the Texas Public Policy Foundation Center for Effective Justice and with the group Right on Crime. He joins us from his home in Austin, Texas, and we are taking telephone calls at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you have questions about what you heard in the past hour of this broadcast, we would like to hear from you as to whether or not you are a conservative that agrees with at least the concept of Right on Crime, that conservatives perhaps should be in the forefront of some of the criminal justice reforms and prison reforms that you've heard us discuss this evening, and that sending people to prison and locking them up and throwing away the key, which maybe 15, 20 years ago seemed to be a fashionable and very politically popular thing to do, maybe it's not such a wise thing to do. So we want to get your reaction to that. But, Mark, again, welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. Nice to have you with us for our second hour this evening.
Thank you.
Before we take a call, I'd like to kind of expand on something that you alluded to in the last segment of the first hour, and that is you talked about the over-criminalization. We've already talked about the over-incarceration, but the number of crimes is expanding that sends people to prison in the first place.
Yes, it's pretty remarkable. You know, we have now found out from there was an attempt by the Congressional Research Office to count the number of federal crimes, and they got to over 4,500, and then they gave up because they couldn't even count the rest. And that's just the statutory offenses. There are many regulatory offenses created by federal and state and even local agencies. So it's tremendous. Here in Texas, for example, we found there's 11 felonies dealing with harvesting oysters. So many of these crimes are not things one would traditionally have thought would be a criminal offense. They're often things that regulate ordinary business activity. And so it's...
But they are prosecuted? I mean, there's a lot of laws around the books that are not prosecuted. These are laws that are being prosecuted as well?
Well, you know, frankly, many of them probably are never prosecuted, but the problem is it gives prosecutors and police tremendous power that they can, you know, there was a quote from the head of the secret police under Joseph Stalin. He said, "Bring me the man, I'll find the crime." And that's exactly the problem, is it becomes, you can charge anybody with a felony virtually. Mm-hmm. And that means there's unlimited discretion, and that can lead to people being singled out for political reasons, or just someone who's trying to make a name for themselves by, you know, prosecuting people. But, you know, there was for example, a fisherman, someone who was importing seafood from Central America, went to U.S. prison for eight years because they didn't have the right forms filled out and that they didn't put them in the right packages and that sort of thing.
Mark, we have people that are calling in at 1-800-723-8029. We'd like to hear from everyone, but if there is an ex-offender that is listening to the broadcast this evening that would like to offer maybe your unique perspective on what we're discussing, would be interested in your call as well. Let's go to Fenton, Michigan, where Michael is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air, Michael.
Yeah, good evening. Yeah, I got a few things. I am an ex-offender. I believe what they could do is they could spend these resources before these people go to prison to, you know, they have the probation officers and the parole officers, mm-hmm. and that they could work with these people like they do sort of after they get out of prison, and to work to spend these funds on making them successful, and then they won't be doing the things that they're doing. Another thing is my particular case, I had a court-appointed attorney. I didn't get no representation. I ended up going to a prison for a crime that I didn't commit. I'm still on parole right now. I got basically 5 months to go on parole.
How many years were you in, and what were you charged and convicted of, Michael?
Well, hang on, let me finish this. So I'm still on parole. So they basically run the prisons as a business, and the police officers will lie when they go to court. The judges will allow that. The prosecutors are in on it. They run these people through there like cattle, and then they don't have no programs in prison really at all. The food is terrible. There's no training, and there's no, you know, and so they come out and back in. And when they come out on parole, the parole officers are harassing them. There's no help for them. And those people that need help, not like myself, I'm doing good on my own, but a lot of those guys need help, and they're not getting it, and they're not going to get it. And, you know, basically I stood up to them. They weren't educating my kids, and so we pulled the kids out. The wife had, you know, a bachelor's and a master's, and so we ended up in court with a superintendent lying, the judge allowing him to lie, and then...
Michael, in your particular case, I want to kind of focus if we can. I appreciate your background. I think it gives us a good perspective of where you're coming from. But again, in your particular case, because most people don't talk to people who are on parole, what do you have to do? Someone who's on parole, how often do you have to report, and what do you have to report?
Well, because they said I assaulted 3 police officers and I didn't, they got me on a tether. I report every 2 weeks. And so I report every 2 weeks. I just go into the office. I give them a schedule. They keep me locked up in the house. I get out twice a week for 5 hours, and I just write down where I'm going to go, you know, because the people that did this to us, they know what they did. They know what they did, and they know that they lied. So,
and how long do you have to? How long do you have to do this?
I had 2 years. It's basically a waste of time. They wasted 2 years of my life, stopped me from getting any production, doing anything, and being a useful citizen that can contribute to society, and put me in a holding pattern for 2 years. I was only in prison for a year and 12 days because they knew what they did.
Michael, listen, thank you very much for your call. Question to you, Mark. Let's talk about training, because am I correct that once upon a time, the American prison system was held up as a pinnacle to prisons around the world, because we did take seriously at one point the rehabilitative aspect of prisons. First of all, is that true? And if so, when did we move away from an attempt to rehabilitate criminals to just housing them?
Well, you know, I think that it's interesting because the two things that he talked about was the lack of resources on the front end of the system in terms of probation, where you could actually successfully supervise many people in the community so they don't have to be either initially sent to or revoked from probation to prison. Mm-hmm. And then the second issue, the lack of programming, you know, in prisons. And I think that those both have a common thread, which is that from the early 70s to just a few years ago, we saw a sixfold increase in the incarceration rate in this country, from just several hundred thousand people locked up to now 2.3 million. And so what happened was, in terms of state budgets, all of the money, almost all the money, had to go into just running the prisons, paying for, you know, staff salaries, correctional health care, staff health care. And so that left very little money for both the front end of the system, the programs that can effectively keep people out of prison and still hold them accountable. And then number two, very little money for programs in prison to teach them a skill, to deal with cognitive rehabilitation, substance abuse, mental illness, and so forth. So what we've seen in the last several years and what we've been promoting is to say, look, let's stop, you know, building more and more prisons, and let's look at what alternatives we could put a fraction of the money into and get better public safety results.
And when we come back, I want to talk more about that. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We are talking this evening with Mark Levin, and he is in Austin, Texas. He is with Right on Crime. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Mark Levin, he is joining us in Austin, Texas. He is with Right on Crime. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Let's head to Texas, where Kevin is listening to us in Temple, Texas, on KLBJ. Go ahead, Kevin.
Good evening. I think that a lot of these alternatives over the years have been pursued by the courts. I've been a prosecutor for over 20 years, and I guess the thing that impresses or surprised me most when I first got into prosecution was how much time the courts do take with some of these people. People that I know aren't going to succeed on probation, but they put them on probation anyway and give them a chance. And I think what we're facing, I mean, in the 50s, I think I've heard it said a couple of times that the biggest problem in schools was like chewing gum and talking. And now we have people, children bringing weapons to school, you know, all kinds of aberrant behavior in the classroom, hitting, beating up teachers. So we're dealing with a different type of individual. And it's really hard for society to create a healthy family. And a lot of these people, the situations that they come from, you're surprised that they're even still standing, let alone standing for a judge getting ready to be sent to prison because
here,
the situations are so bad.
But here's a question that I would say, Kevin, because, again, obviously, we at least the focus of tonight's program is not the breakdown in the family and what causes someone to go to prison. And we realize there's all kinds of reasons and roads that lead you to prison. Tonight's focus is once you have been trapped, once you cross into that compound where they close the bars behind you, what can we as a society be doing better to make sure that those people who made a mistake, some of them may be mentally ill, they've made a mistake, they're incarcerated. What can we as taxpayers do, and what can we as a nation do to assist those people so that when their time is up and they are released, they will not come back again? Can we use that time that we have with them? Can we try to improve their lives? Obviously, the first trip through the system didn't work for them because of a variety of reasons. They screwed up and they were sent to prison. What can we do to make that 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years productive? That's what we're trying to deal with. As a prosecutor, can you offer any insight into that? I mean, I think you would probably agree we need some type of training or mental mental counseling, mental health counseling that goes on in prisons.
I'm pretty sure that I don't know about other states, but I know Texas for the longest time has had a whole school district within the prison system, and they have a choice of either working or going to school, or they can just do nothing. I mean, courts come in and tell us you can't force these people to do anything. So, you know, it's their choice what they want to do, and I think it all boils down to that, basically. It's their choice what they want to do with their lives, and we can't make them be model citizens.
Mark, your response.
Well, I think that those are very interesting points. I will say in Texas, and I can't speak for every other state, but in Texas, all inmates, they actually are required to work unless they have a medical reason why they can't work. Now, a lot of the jobs are doing laundry and building furniture for state legislators, which unfortunately may not translate that well into the private sector. I'd like to see more of them getting vocational certificates. You know, if they come out as a welder, there's almost definitely a job waiting for them. But, you know, obviously, I think the caller is right. There are some offenders who are, you know, incorrigible. There's serial killers. There's people that should never get out and all of that. But I do think what we've seen through drug courts and other programs is there are certainly many offenders who can be redeemed, who can turn it around and be productive, law-abiding citizens.
I think we, you know, I'll close with this. I think we have to be careful with this because the taxpayers are not going to look favorably on a huge amount of programs in prisons to help people who have robbed them, burglarized their home, beaten up their sister, you know, I mean, it's so you kind of have to walk a fine line. I mean, I'm all for giving people help, but I'm not for rewarding people who have shown time and time again that they do not really deserve.
Kevin, what we have to say to the people who think like you just articulated, what we have to say to them, because we have to say to them, you know what, if we leave that person in prison and we do nothing, the chances of that person getting out of prison and doing something wrong again is considerably higher than if we invest some time and effort while they're in prison. So, I mean, you know, granted, you don't want to reward someone. Someone that is spending 3, 4, 5, 7 years of their life, I don't believe they think they're being rewarded by being educated. Because if they get out and they walk down a straight and narrow path, then society has benefited from that investment. And so you can't just throw away. We've got to move on. Listen, thank you for your call.
Can I just add one thing?
One quick thing. Yes.
One of the things we did in Texas is we found people were being trained to be barbers in prison, but they couldn't get a license when they went out. So we changed that so they could get a provisional. And, you know, even if you don't care about the offender, if they're working, they're less likely to. They may be living next to you. They're less likely to be a threat to you and others.
What question, Mark? Is there objection to some unions that they do not want prisoners to be working in meaningful jobs because those people would be taking work away from union workers on the outside?
There's been, not with regard to the license, occupational licensing once they're out, but with respect to the Prison Industry Enhancement Program, PIE, which the number of states have, there's an exemption that allows it under federal law, that there have been not only unions but also companies that have tried to, and in some cases successfully, reduce the number of PIE sites in various prisons because they say it unfairly competes with, you know, the private sector. So, but most of them make things that are otherwise be made in China or other countries.
Let's move on to Shannon. Shannon is driving in Washington, listening to us on KXLY, identified as an ex-offender. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey there, guys. Hey, I had a quick question for Mark. I'm here in Washington. I served almost 16 years at the age of 16. For second-degree murder and first-degree manslaughter. Excuse me. And my question was, what do you think the effects of mandatory sentencing is on the cost of incarceration? Because we've seen a lot of that, and our population has increased in our prisons exponentially since we passed laws here in Washington. And also, I'll take my answer off the air, the effects of medicating our prisoners, because during my time, I saw a lot of that in prison, and I was curious about what they felt about that, because I heard you guys talking about the mental health issues.
Okay. You know what? Shannon, do me a favor. Stay on the line. We may want to have a follow-up with you. Stay on the line, but let's go to Mark Levin, let you respond, because, again, mandatory sentencing is something we talked about at length in the first hour, and that is really – that's the reason why there's been such a huge jump in prison population.
Well, certainly one reason, you know, and the thing is, what people have to remember is that when you have a mandatory minimum, you know, for any offense, what you're doing is taking away discretion from judges and juries to look at the specific facts of the case, and instead, frankly, you're vesting it in the legislature, because that's who sets politicians, which most people don't have the highest opinion of, they're setting, without any reference to the specific facts of the case, what the mandatory prison term is going to be for various crimes. And so many states have moved away from these mandatory minimums in the last several years, particularly as it relates to nonviolent offenses. You saw, for example, New York repealed most of the Rockefeller drug mandatory minimums. So I think that's been a positive development. Obviously, more serious offenses, it is appropriate for long terms, but judges and juries can certainly give those out without necessarily having a mandatory minimum.
Mark, in the elected officials that you deal with, and you deal with them at the state level as well as the national level, do you believe there is an understanding or a greater understanding that some of the laws we have now, which were a result of get tough, you know, law and order stances that were demanded by the public within the last 15 years, do you believe that today's generation of elected officials understand that their predecessor lawmakers made some pretty bad decisions?
I think most do. I think the And we've seen, you know, tremendous legislation go through just in the last year or two in Ohio, Georgia, many other states. I think that the key is having the bipartisan collaboration, because I was actually, we had an event with Grover Norquist speaking about this just about a week ago, and he said this was with respect to the narrowing of the crack powder disparity in Washington in Congress, which was successful to narrow it, and he said everyone was for it as long as everyone was for it, and that's a critical thing. So if everyone is kind of holding hands on the edge of the diving board, the water doesn't look so cold beneath them.
Mm-hmm. Listen, Shannon, last word to you. Any last minute comment for you, and then we're going to move on.
No, guys, I definitely enjoy the topic tonight, and I appreciate you guys bringing light to that, because it's a problem that our country is going to face for years to come if we don't correct.
Thank you very much. And by the way, I just want to take this moment to say that one of the reasons why we are doing this program tonight is, okay, the election is over, okay? The Republicans were sent back to control Congress. The Democrats control the Senate. We got a Democrat in the White House. Now is the time to look at issues in a bipartisan way. And I think one of the most interesting things is this organization, Right on Crime. Again, it's conservatives. They're based in Texas. They have a lot of leading conservatives that are part of their organization, and yet they are in sync with the NAACP and a recent report that they came out with called Misplaced Priorities: Over Incarcerate, Under Educate. So those right of center, those left of center on the political, whether it's at the state level or federal level, there's a lot of compromise. There's a lot of agreement on what can be done. It's now time to do it. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Mark Levin joins us. He is with Right on Crime. He is joining us from his home in Austin, Texas, where that organization is based. He is with the Texas Public Policy Foundation's Center for Effective Justice. In the last hour, Mark, you referenced voters in the state of California. And it was voters in the state of California a long time ago who put the pressure on their elected officials, and when they came out with their three strikes and you're out policy, that sent a lot of people in California to prison. It was a popular move that got picked up by other states. A lot of people went to prison because they felt that the public mood was vehemently against crime. There was a wave of anti-tough-on-crime rhetoric in the country, and it was popular for politicians to be on that side, and yet the voters now in California are having maybe some second thoughts about the wisdom of that, because they now live in a state that's bankrupt. Can you tell us a little bit about maybe some changing moods in the state of California, Mark?
Sure. Well, there was a ballot measure in this past election in November to narrow the three strikes law to require that the third strike in California be at least a serious crime, because previously the third strike could be something like stealing a candy bar and you were, you know, into prison for the rest of your life, you know, mandatorily without any discretion for the judge or jury. So it was 68.6% of the voters in California voted to in favor of this ballot measure, which now requires that the third strike be another serious crime. I think it was a very positive result. And there was also a ballot measure in Oklahoma which gave the parole board the power to parole nonviolent offenders, where previously positive parole decision had to be signed by the governor. And so that was also, I think, significant that was approved.
Before the break, we're going to go to calls in just a moment. Before the break, I referenced the support that your organization gave to a report. Actually, it came out last year from the NAACP. Their report was called Misplaced Priorities: Over Incarcerate, Under Educate. And the report found that state spending on prisons grew six times faster than the rate of state spending on higher education. And it went through some of the devastating statistics that I gave at the beginning of the broadcast. But from a political perspective, can you talk about how those organizations, even the ACLU, has been supportive of some of the things that you have been involved with, and there's common ground there? Talk a little bit about the uniqueness of this left-right coalition to deal with a real live problem that has serious economic impact on the country.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that you're absolutely right that this is one of the few areas, it seems, where there's been, you know, bipartisan reforms that have been successful over the last couple of years. And so I think that the, you know, we certainly do have some differences with the NAACP and the ACLU and others, you know, and there's examples, I mean, things like drug courts. Some of the liberal groups have said, well, their drug courts are too tough because they test people regularly and they have to show up, and if they keep missing drug tests and things, they may have to spend a weekend in jail and such. So we kind of like the carrot and stick approach. Some of those on the real far left don't like the stick part of the carrot and stick. So there are differences, but, you know, there's a lot of common ground, and that is to say, look, if we can do things that not only save money but make us safer, because, you know, when one of the research has increasingly shown when you take a low-level nonviolent offender, someone with just a drug problem, for example, that you send them to prison for 6 months to learn bad things next to the really bad guys, they actually may be more of a danger when they come out than if you would put them into a drug court or into another probation program that has real teeth and treatment to it.
Do you know anything that is existing or that's pending in Washington, D.C. now, either in Congress legislatively or at the executive level with changes in the Bureau of Prisons at the federal level? Is there anything that's pending that is likely to change in the next 3 to 6, 9 months that's being done because of cost saving that the federal government must now be looking at seriously?
Yes, and, you know, and I want to make the point that a lot of these policies, even if they didn't save money, they do, but they'd still be good policies. Because let me give you an example on the federal system. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has an overcrowding problem now. They've, you know, been asking Congress for more and more money to build new facilities, and yet there's an existing law where they could be transitioning more people for the last small portion of their sentence to being under house arrest and some transition to the community instead of just being released without any supervision. And they haven't been taking full advantage of that. It appears they may be starting now to take more advantage of that.
Is
and
that
also understand?
Is that part of the Second Chance Act?
No, it's not. It's authority that's been in law for longer than the Second Chance Act. But the Second Chance Act has a number of worthwhile initiatives to assist particularly state and local governments with reentry. But I wanted to mention one of the top Republicans in the Senate is expected to introduce in the next month or two some significant legislation that would bring some of the positive reforms we've seen at the state level, things like earned time credits, better use of risk and needs assessments and things like that, to the federal system. You know, because on the last 2 years, after 38 years of prison growth in the incarceration rate in this country, the last 2 years, more states have seen a decline in incarceration rate than growth, but the federal prison system has kept growing unabated. And what you've also seen is more and more offenders, street drug crimes and things that used to be solely the province of state justice systems, those offenders going into the federal system.
Who's going to introduce that legislation?
Well, we understand Senator Cornyn from Texas.
Senator Cornyn of Texas. So please keep us informed as to where that is, because one of the things we hope to getting people interested in this broadcast this evening is there are very specific things that need to be done. I mean, everyone knows that we have a major fiscal problem in the United States. We have to put everything on the table. And again, we want to stress, at least I want to stress, that again, what we're talking about tonight is not letting hardened criminals out of prison early if they deserve to be there. But the question is, when you have 2.3 million people incarcerated, more than any other nation in the world, there are some people in prison who are in prison for too long. And there are alternative ways in which they can be punished. You can keep an eye on them. And they're more effective and more efficient ways of doing it. One last question, and then we're going to go back to calls. What does an ankle bracelet cost?
Well, there are a lot of different types, but the most primitive just kind of lets the whoever supervising you know that you're at home. It's radio frequency, and that could be $5 a day. Then there's GPS, which tells them exactly where you are, including whether you go out of a zone you're supposed to be at, if you go too close to a school or something you're not supposed to get that close to. And so that could cost, you know, $10 a day. But, you know, the average cost of prison is $65, $70 a day.
So we have the technology today. It exists where we could monitor people that need to be monitored for a period of time that would be significantly cost effective. And that's the type of common sense that we need in government. We need it in all forms of the criminal justice system. And again, as taxpayers, you should be concerned and you should let your members of Congress know that you want them to think, when they think of justice and they think of incarceration, they've got to think smartly. Don't just throw away the key. Think smartly how we're going to keep track of those that we believe need to be kept track of because they have violated a law. Let's go to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where George is listening to us on WRNN. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. Great show.
Thank you.
I got two very controversial solutions to, one, the recidivism rate and possibly financial destruction going on because of the prison system.
Okay.
First one, I think it's possible that for all nonviolent offenders, after their maximum sentence is completed, whether they serve it or not, their record should be expunged without cause. That's the first issue. Second one, the financial one. Now, this is really crazy, but if there is a possibility of nonviolent offenders again being able to buy out of their time, some of their jail time, like a percentage of net worth or something to that effect, would that be a possibility?
I'm not so sure I like the second one because it obviously it gives unfavorable treatment to those that may be wealthy.
Right, but it's a percentage.
Yeah, okay. Let's get Mark's response to those two suggested reforms.
Well, the first one does fit more with what we would support, which would be wouldn't be quite as broad, I don't think, as that. But in generally speaking, there might be a few exceptions, but right now, I mean, it is so difficult for people to, even once they've been on the straight and narrow for years, they still have even a misdemeanor on your record can prevent you from getting a job, can prevent you from getting housing, and so we're making it more difficult for people to, move towards a law-abiding, productive lifestyle. So I think that this is a major issue that needs to be addressed. About 20% of Americans have a criminal record, and I believe a huge percentage of the long-term unemployed have a criminal record.
Yeah.
So
it's common sense, and it goes back to something that I think we are taught in grammar school, and that is, if you violate a crime, you've got to be prepared to do the time. And then the next phrase that was always taught, at least when I was going to school, was you have to go away and you have to pay your debt to society. You go away, you pay your debt to society. But even in this nation, a debt should not last forever. That's why we have bankruptcy laws. At some point, the debt is over. The debt has been paid. And someone who spends 5, 10, 15, 20 years of their life in prison, it seems to me to then tack on, more problems in getting a job is just, it's wrong, and it's, in my view, it's un-American. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, where this program comes from every Sunday night from coast to coast and border to border. And last week, I had the pleasure of celebrating my 20th year on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. So now in our 21st year, talking to you coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. Let's head to Roselle. They're listening to the Big 89 WLS. Brian, you're on the air coast to coast. Go ahead.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. Mr. Levin, I agree with your viewpoint and your goals completely. I think you're on the right track. But I'm a big picture guy. And let's put your goals up against the realities that exist within the American labor market, especially at the bottom end of the American labor market. I have 30 years in construction. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, I worked with a fair amount of ex-cons. I worked with a lot of guys that have been to county jail. And they were all indigenous people. They grew up in the United States. Now, if you look at the reality of releasing ex-cons into the labor market, most of whom are poorly educated or modestly educated, and they got convicted felons stamped on their record. The problem that exists now is is that most American employers would rather hire an immigrant or an illegal immigrant. And if you look at all the occupations that most ex-cons would move into back in the 70s, they are now currently occupied by immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal. And, you know, we got to look at reality. Supply and demand applies to the labor market. And unfortunately, after this election, we have both major parties are bending over backwards to pander to Hispanics and legalize all the ones that are here and increase the level of immigration. So if we look at just the supply and demand at the bottom end of the labor market where most ex-cons are going to end up, we have a huge problem.
And Brian, you state the issue very, very well. Let's let Mark respond to it. But well stated. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting concern. I think that what we were talking about is expand the ability of nonviolent ex-offenders to get this conviction off their record if they've been, you know, complying with the terms of their supervision and have not violated additional laws and so forth. And so then there would not be anything on their record, at least as far as the public. Now, they would still be, for example, if you do what we have in Texas, although we need to expand it, non-disclosure, prosecutors and judges could still see it. It could be used to enhance a subsequent conviction if they were ever convicted of something again, but it's not something employers or an apartment complex or something like that would be able would see. And again, you know, I don't think it should be automatic. I think it should be, you have to earn it, and you earn it based on, you know, your compliance for some period with. But I think sooner rather than later that we can get people who, again, you know, and again, this isn't for someone who has a 30 offense.
But Brian is correct that, again, the jobs that most ex-offenders would be eligible for or would fight for are the jobs that are now being taken by those illegal immigrants that have come to the country. Would you acknowledge that?
Well, I think there is a competition for those jobs like every other job. I don't think that. I think immigration policy, you know, is a separate question that has other considerations. But I think that certainly there's, you know, of course, if the economy was doing better, there would be more of these jobs to go around. But
right.
Can I make one more quick point?
Very quick, Brian, then we're going to move on.
Yeah, and you know what? And the irony is the establishment, the employers, are the ones breaking the laws, and technically they are criminals because they want to hire illegal immigrants.
That's
right. You know, employers look at the deal. You know, who's the better deal? Do they want the desperate immigrant that's just dying for a job, or do they want to deal with someone that's been sitting in state prison for 8 years and is a potential problem? You know, they're always going to pass over the ex-con. They'll figure out they're an ex-con. It's very simple. You know, hey, Joe, what have you been doing for the last 6 years?
Brian,
they're going to look at your record.
Brian, we have an ex-offender on the line with us right now. Tom calling from Redding, California, listening to us on KGOE. And I understand you're having a heck of a time finding a job.
The biggest problem is as soon as you go in to get a job, they've got the question, are you an ex-felon? Well, in the 1970s, I actually lived in Illinois. And what happened is I got arrested for marijuana. They gave me 8 years in Joliet. And I went to school and got my GED, did everything that I was supposed to do. And I took accounting classes only to find out that under Illinois law, if you're an ex-convict, you're not allowed to be an accountant. And I mean, and the way it was set up is if you went to school, you'd get $30 a month. If you went to $15 a month. If you went to work at the furniture factory, then you'd get almost $300 a month. After 90 days being incarcerated in Joliet, they had me across the street helping put the roof on Dwight, which is the ladies' correctional center there in Illinois. And the whole time I was there, Warden Fairchild, who was a warden of Joliet, got arrested for embezzling funds. And at Statesville, got arrested for running a chop shop out of prison.
All right, on that note, we are out of time, not because of what you're talking about, but we really are. The old clock on the wall does say we're out of time. Mark Levin, thank you very much for being with us this evening. Mark Levin has been with us. He is with the Texas Public Policies Foundation Center for Effective Justice. It's right on crime. Give us the website and 10 more seconds of a pitch.
RightOnCrime.com. I think we've heard tonight why it's so important that we reform our criminal justice system to improve public safety and get people back on the right track.
Right. I appreciate your taking the time to be available for this for 2 hours. And judging from the response of our phone calls, maybe we touched a nerve. Maybe we inspired a few people to stay on this particular topic. It's one we will return to. We can't solve all of the ills on this program. But again, we can focus on some, at least as it relates to the fiscal aspects of this. You know, we want justice in this country. We want smart justice. We want incarceration, but we want smart incarceration. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is Beyond the Beltway. Our thanks to Tom Vera-Cruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Good night from Chicago.